What's up, everybody? Kings and priests. What's up, Dean?
Hey, mate. Everything. Those challenges getting cameras to work here, but we're all good.
Technical difficulties, but we've got it all figured out, huh?
Yep.
So it's Masters week.
Yeah.
And Tiger's plan.
I know. I was just watching a little bit, actually.
Which is pretty crazy.
At masters.com.
Yep.
Yeah, man. I think the whole world is, you know, pulling for him. If he may has a top 10, it'll be, you know, a miracle. If he wins, everyone will be out of their mind.
Yeah. I have a funny master story for you that you're going to love. So this morning, so a buddy of mine plays for a country artist. He's an MD and bass player for a country artist. They're at the Masters all week. They've been there all week and all weekend, and they're just playing a bunch of shows. So he said they were at this party last night after playing a show. I think it was like a CAA party, 2 a.m. Him and all the band members are all talking to somebody. Or not, sorry, not this morning, yesterday. And someone says, hey, I got a tea time at Augusta tomorrow at 7:30. I can't make it. Do you guys want it? So they're like, okay, yeah. So they go, they finish the party. They go back to the tour bus with all the intention of waking up that morning to go play. They all slept through their alarms and didn't go play a round at Augusta.
Really? That's
hard to do. He told me that this morning.
There's two or three courses in America that are like virtually impossible to get on. That's one of them.
I was going to say, that's like once in a lifetime opportunity.
Oh, yeah. That right? And like Cypress Point. Pine Valley, you know, those kind of courses are epic.
Yeah. So. He texted me that this morning and was like, man, we were just up too late. And I was like, man, I don't know that there's anything that could keep me from, I'd probably shoot 200 on Augusta the week before the Masters. But I saw this company, this golf company that I love, Malbon. They're like a golf fashion gear company or whatever. Right. And they sent out an Instagram yesterday once Tiger announced that he was playing, that if Tiger wins, anything that is purchased through their site starting yesterday all the way through Sunday will be refunded in full, which I thought was a genius marketing Absolutely. Move. So we got a lot of stuff to talk about today. Yep. Let's talk briefly, and we don't have to go into it because I feel like you can't look anywhere without seeing it in the news, but Elon Musk buying almost 9.5% of Twitter in the last couple of weeks. That's pretty crazy. Well, first I want to get like your thoughts on it. My first question is when you're buying up this much of a stock, like, I mean, you can't just do that quietly.
No, right? you can't go on your Robinhood account and drop $3 billion on Twitter. Right. So, it would have been maybe a month in the making. The stock wouldn't have just been from the open market alone. He would have probably acquired it from other big stakeholders. You know, the board would have known about it at Twitter. Like, so once it became publicly known, I think Twitter was up like 25%. But you know, look, there's a guy. He's worth, you know, depending on what day it is and what the stock at Tesla is 250, 300 billion. And like, what a cool, like, he believes in free speech. And so much so that he drops, you know, $3 billion on this stake in Twitter with the full intention of, and he's on the board that was announced and he's going to shake it back up. And, you know, it's not really a left right kind of political thing. It's a, do we believe that free speech is important to be free? He rightly calls Twitter the town hall, you know, of the world. And banning people for expressing views that you don't agree with is a fast way to, you know, destroy democracy. So power to him, man. And I think that between the Twitter stock going up and Tesla stock going up, I think he basically covered the cost.
He made
a couple of billion in the same day.
So. Okay, so it made me think of a question. So I was listening yesterday to the latest This Week in Startups, where I think Cal Canis interviews that Antonio Garcia Martinez and some other guy. Yep. They start talking about this, and they're talking about this idea of free speech. And something that got brought up that I actually had never thought about on this thought of like free speech in Twitter is it free speech when it is like bots and algorithms creating a lot of the content, right? So hopefully Elon can go in and figure out like what's real, what's not real.
Right.
Yeah,
I just don't think Twitter has done enough. Like Twitter is worth 40 something billion, right? It's not. Mm-hmm. Like it's a big company, but it's not like the other socials. It's a very targeted type platform and it's very powerful and it has a lot of power in it. So they should be doing everything they can. And I can't believe they can't do this. Anyone who's not a real account, they shouldn't be on Twitter. And they gotta like close that all up and clean it up. And sure, hate speech, 100%. Like, no way. There's no place for that. But so, hopefully
it'll be it'll be a really good thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally.
And just a brilliant troll by Elon also, as usual.
Of all time.
Okay. So, all right, I'm excited about this next one. So today's Thursday, April 7th. So I guess it was yesterday that news broke that Fast, which is, I guess from everyone's perspective, was a very high growth startup that was founded in 2019, shut down. So I guess like top line, and you may know more, but essentially they started in 2019. Looks like they've raised almost $125 million since being founded in 2019. Stripe led a big round in 2021, in the fall of 2021. So basically what's happened is this company who raised on this massive valuation, raised a bunch of cash, come to find out they're burning $10 million a month to generate $50,000 a month in sales. So let's stop there. And what happened here?
Someone didn't, like, my first gut is there's some fraud involved because, like, the fall of 2021 is like 6 months ago.
Yeah.
And I can't for the life of me work out if you're looking at a financial statement and any kind of just one sheet P&L on a company that if you were seeing 10 million being burned and 50 grand being earned, that would not raise some kind of flag.
Right.
You spend money to grow 100%, but that's insane. Like spending 10 million to get 50K. So I don't know if there's some fraud here. Certainly someone was not dotting the I's and crossing the T's on funding the round. So, I mean, it goes without saying that that's unsustainable. And then it's obviously, that's it. They're closing the doors, I think. And so that's it. You just can't do that. And it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And you know, also the product, it was a one click kind of paying button on websites.
It was just just a button, right? That's all it was.
That's all it was. And, you know, when you're up against Amazon Pay, PayPal, you know, Shopify, like, these guys all do it really well. They're already pumping billions of dollars through their, you know, transaction platform. Someone saw something in it, but it doesn't shock me.
How does somebody raise $125 million? I mean,
it's actually not that hard. that's a lot for a, you know, a seed or an A round, but even though the public markets are getting beat up right now, the amount of money that's been made in the last 10, 15 years within venture and private equity is you know, unimaginable. So if you have an idea and you show some kind of product market fit and you can, you know, do some kind of pro forma out 5 years and show that you've got this really big TAM, like there's so much money out there. And they've got to put it to work. Like venture funds exist to spend money, invest, take bets, you know, bet on entrepreneurs, bet on ideas. And they're going to get that money deployed. And while it's sitting in the bank account earning, you know, 1% interest, they're going backwards. They're trying to 10X this, right? So sometimes silly money follows silly ideas and you get situations like this. But, you know, it's just not that hard to raise money in this kind of environment. And I don't think that's going to change. We've had 15 to 20 years of compounding returns like we've never seen. And every day, and I know some of them and I talk to some of them and I just read, every day I hear a new fund. You know, I have a neighbor in Park City I think like he's a private equity guy. I got Menhaz. He goes, yeah, I'm fundraising at the moment. I go, oh, what are you guys doing? We're doing a $2 billion fund. And I said, oh, how long is that going to take? He says, maybe 3 months. You know, we'll have it all buttoned up.
Wow.
And so he like, and his job is to go and, you know, get the cash for the next fund and then go, mm-hmm. and then they go and deploy that. And they don't even do much tech. They do Midwest, a lot of industrial stuff. Mm. And I said, how come it's so easy to raise that much money that quickly? He goes, well, everybody who's invested in the previous seven funds is just dying to give you money again because they gave you 10 million, you gave them back 50. And so then they get 25 of that and give it to you again because you're going to give them back. It's just, so that's been going on for 20 years now. Mm-hmm. And as a result, there's just, which is great, right? Because even though we might have a recession, coming up here or things might slow and growth might pull back, best time to start a business is when the economy is bad. I think there's going to be tons of capital around to go and grow companies.
Yeah. So kind of like, I guess one of my practical questions when I read a story like this is, so this founder, and this is, I guess this is more of those like how the sausage is made kind of questions, like nitty gritty. When I read a story like this and I see this founder who's raised this much money, talk to me about, I guess, like some of the behind the scenes practicalities of this. Like this founder has probably made tens of millions of dollars personally from selling his equity in this business. Like, how does that work? I mean,
Potentially, I
think for the average person can look at this and like you said, there's fraud involved potentially. But yeah, this guy has been like
founders don't usually make money until year 5 to 10, mm-hmm. where you have a business that's making money where you can go and do a round and have what's called secondary as a part of the round. So typically you're raising money to go spend in your business to grow your business. Mm-hmm. Certainly spending 10 million to earn 50,000, not good. Spending $1 million a month to make $500,000 a month, do that all day long because that $500,000 is going to get to $1 million at some point. You're going to go past and you're going to be making a profit. But founders get issued what's known as common stock typically. Mm-hmm. Investors get preferred stock. Preferred stock gets paid first when there's a liquidation event until such time. And preferred stock is worth more in the private, market. Until there's a point where common stock is now less risky, right? I.e. the business has got, big market share, it's gone profitable.
It's no longer a risky startup. It's now a sustainable, stable business.
Right. So now you're in your series, C and D, and like now your business is maturing. It's still a growth business. You're still spending money to make money. But, investors, and especially of late, the last 5 years, founders, like they want to buy a house too, and they've lived and bootstrapped and everything. So, but it's, I'd be shocked if this guy got a lot of money early from this deal because typically founders don't do that.
Got it. Okay. So this isn't a scenario. The average person reads this and sees this company raised $140 million or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then now they're shutting down their business. There's not just like there's not a team of people behind the scenes who have each made millions of dollars and are now just going.
Someone's lost $125 million. That's what's happened.
Yep.
And a bunch of people. And he was probably on $150,000 a year, just trying to make a living, probably living in the valley or somewhere expensive where $150K mm-hmm. gets you nothing, and he was just grinding it out. But there's this famous scene. I don't know if you're watching We Crashed. The one on Adam Newman.
Is that the Hulu show, right? On WeWork, yeah. It's on the list. I want to watch it, yeah.
It's really good. So there's a scene where, it's year whatever of WeWork. It's, he just got the $4 billion from Masa, and SoftBank, and he's like flying all these, buying jets and stuff like this. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't have much personal money. And Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan Chase, he goes to the branch at first and says, I need a line of credit for $50 million. The guy's like, and he's like, just Google me. So he goes up to see Jamie Dimon. Jamie Dimon's like, he's like, can I have $50 million line of credit? And Jamie just says, you need 100. consider me your personal banker. So he gets $100 million against the stock of WeWork, right?
Against the stock, right? Yeah.
So anyway,
that is man. That so let's okay. Let's pretend for a second that this wasn't fraud. Let's pretend this was a CEO that was great in a boardroom. He was he was a great pitchman. He was super optimistic and focused on his business. And let's say he just he had all the best intentions in the world, wildly optimistic.
Right.
Where's the line between that optimism and salesmanship and just straight up fraud and basically lying to to investors?
The lessons for me in this is when you're running a business and you're trying to grow it and you're trying to grow it fast, that's going to cost. And I, on a daily basis, wanted to know my cash position, i.e. money that we've either made and it's profit and it's sitting in a bank somewhere, or money that we've raised and that's sitting in our bank. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we talked about this, the what's the runway? So if it's costing me $250,000 a month to run my business, and I've got $1 million in the bank, but I'm not making a profit, I've got 4 months till the company dies. Mm-hmm. If I've got $5 million in the bank, I've got a couple of years before the company dies. At some point, I've got to see revenue go up and hit that point to where my what costs me to run the business, I've got to get to 250. If I'm spending 250 to grow and employ people and like all the, you know, top line stuff that it costs you to run your business, at some point I got to have a date in the future. So if I'm at 100K revenue and I'm growing 10% a month, I can look out and go, oh, well, if I keep my expenses at 250, my revenue is going to hit that in 13 months. The problem is I want to grow faster. So I spend more than 250. I start buying more Google ads. I start putting on more engineers. And now my 250 costs, but that's okay if I can draw the line to profitability. And if I can't, and my company is still growing and there's still plenty of market to go get, I'll go back to the venture crowds and I'll say, hey, listen, here's what we've done. We're in year three. Can you give me another 10 million? Here's how we're going to spend it. And boom, and they'll do it because they can see it. So this was a 2019 company. I cannot, unless they had a bunch of business and then lost it or they couldn't, I don't know how you get this money and in 2 years burn it all.
It's gone.
Without having the correlation of those numbers. Mm-hmm. It's expenses and revenue. And not, so it's not knowing your runway. And I'm just, that's why I'm just, it doesn't add up to me because you don't just go and burn millions of dollars every month with no trajectory to profitability.
Right.
Or at least, you know, getting to this point where you go back to the marketplace and get more cash and you've got this provable business. Because to get that much money, you have to show some financial statements about like, how are you going to do this?
Yeah, well, that was going to be my question, right? Like you said, if they had business booked, there would be contracts or term sheets or letter of intent, like
all of that to get the money. But you know,
to get the money is what in a sense of they were able to go and say, look at this revenue we have coming down the pipe, right?
They had a P&L statement and a balance sheet at a minimum, and like those are two big pieces of paper, you know. They want more than that. They just want you know, a customer list and blah, 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 and I'm going to do a technical review on the product and blah, blah, blah. But at a minimum, you got a P&L and a balance statement. Mm-hmm. And I'm okay at it. This guy's a million times smarter than me that would look at that in about 8 seconds and go,
Something's not right here. Yeah. Weird. Okay. Yeah. Super fascinating story. It'll be interesting to see what this CEO does next. What the next situation is for him.
Yeah. Look, there's a pretty good chance he'll get another chance, you know?
Mm-hmm. right?
Silicon Valley is doing something, very forgiving.
Yeah. Okay, so this next topic quickly is just a tweet that I read this week. And we talk about this a lot, these kinds of things, but I think it's really important. And sure. If there's anything we're going to be repetitive about, it'll probably be things in this world. But I love this tweet. In a startup, you should seek out activities that seem hard, boring, annoying, and unscalable. The highest value tasks are often hidden amongst them, and no one else has noticed because they seem unappealing on the surface.
That's a true statement.
Give me like an example of something like that. And obviously we talk a lot about doing things that are unscalable, but I think it's just worth talking about again.
Totally. So, you know, I had someone pitch me an idea the other day around insurance, right? Doesn't get more boring than insurance. And he's been in and around the insurance industry at giant companies. And he's like, hey, I got this idea for this, you know, for a software business that served the insurance industry. And he explained it all to me. I understood it instantly. And I said, who's the competitor? He says, there's none. And it's a classic, you know, the 70-year-old guys in the boardrooms of insurance companies have not embraced technology. Now you've got all these insurance startups like Lemonade and, you know, and then things like Geico and that have really kind of shifted. This was more of an enterprise level piece of software that would serve the insurance company behind the scenes,
okay,
in the back office. Mm-hmm. And he said, it's all so antiquated, you know? So he's doing a business plan and, you know, like, we might go and try and find some money to do it. But that's the classic thing, right? You've got, and then certainly in my case, Ryan, it was $130 billion essentially, you know, being given to churches in cash and check. Mm-hmm. So what's the opportunity? Digitization of charitable giving. So that's a kind of a classic thing. You're looking for something that's, you know, and I think he uses the term here, hard, boring, annoying. You know,
and unscalable.
Yeah. And so like, so yeah, those are classic things. I know a guy who company, they built an app to help property managers collect the rent, do the, you know, background checks on the tenants. Like it's just a bundled piece of software, right? Mm-hmm. $1 billion company now. So if you can take anything that's done manually and digitize it, slap software and put some payments inside of it, that's the quickest way to, you know, building a pretty awesome company.
Yeah. Let's say somebody has, okay, so like even hearing you say that, my mind starts thinking about, okay, what in my world that I look around and see all the time is something that needs to be, just needs some new technology brought to it.
Yep.
There's nothing about me that is a technologist. And
no, I'm not either.
I'm not a developer.
No.
How does somebody go about, and this is like actually a really practical question. So let's say someone has this idea they want to model out. They want to build a MVP of an app.
Yep.
Do they go on Fiverr and hire a developer? Do they find someone in that they know? What if they don't know a developer? Do they find someone and say, hey, can you build this for me for free and I'll give you half the business? Like,
yep.
I don't know. What are some different ways? I have a friend right now actually that has this idea for in a certain part of the publishing industry. And it's sort of like, he's got this idea. He's not a developer. He's having a difficult time finding a developer because everyone's got 30 projects they're working on.
Right. What I would do is I'd go, you need two things to start, a software, you know, kind of technical type business. You need a co-founder that can go and sell it, and you need a co-founder that can go and build it. So the only, and we all know engineers are hard to find. They're super expensive. The only way you're going to get a technical co-founder is to make them a co-founder. Like the only way you're going to get the technical need fulfilled is by having them. So, you know, there's tons of forums, tons of networks. Doesn't matter where you live, there's a tech scene. You just got to go do the hard work of meeting people, you know, turning up at stuff, find out, you know, where all that kind of world is, you know, happening in your city, and go and start making friends. And, you know, I think we had an episode on choosing your co-founder and
your co-founder
synergies and the values and all that. You got to go through all that, right? Maybe we can link back to that pod because we'll
that
choosing a co-founder is really important. But you basically are going to need a co-founder. If you're a non-technical, you're going to need a co-founder who is technical so you can go and get your MVP out. On the other side too, I was talking to a young guy the other day doing something in mobile, and you know he's a technical guy, and he needs a management sales, you know, not marketing so much, but because that's kind of another skill set. But you know, you got to do everything at the beginning yourself, and so it's super rare that you have a technical person that can go and be the front face and go and sell it. And I was really fortunate, right? I had Barn, you know, the oldest savant son,
the builder,
just build stuff. So we had a head start, but you know, that's critical.
So this statement on this tweet, and then we can jump to the next one, but the highest value tasks are often hidden amongst the things that are, you know, hard, boring, annoying, unscalable. Right. No one has noticed. Do you think, like, is there a world in which, so like you're starting a business, you're a founder, how often do you just sit and just look through the nuts and bolts of what it is that you're doing and just like re-throw stuff up against the wall? Other words, like there's this idea of working the business versus working on the business, right?
So, yeah. Look, you're in it, man. You got to live that thing 24/7. And as you grow, it gets more difficult to do that. You start hiring people to do things that you used to do. But you know, man, we've had situations where I wished I had my eyes on things for periods of time where I didn't, because I hired other people to have their eyes on things. I didn't see them like I saw them, or didn't have the expertise that I hired them for to see what I didn't know. You just got to be in it, man. And you know, we hate doing death by meetings, but it's constantly, weekly, daily, you know, 5 minutes at the beginning of the day, 5 minutes at the end of the day, what got done, what are we working on, like all of that. There's no shortcut to any of that. And you just got to live, eat, sleep, breathe this thing for the first 5 years. Otherwise, you're going to get crushed and die pretty quick.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. So our last topic here, we've got a listener question that got sent in this week. Really good question. So what do you do when you have a business partner? These are faith-based, these are Christian entrepreneurs.
Yep.
Their business partner is an unbeliever.
Yep.
Who thinks they're pulling their weight, but they're not. How do you handle it? In other words, how do you handle
misalignment with the founders?
Misalignment with, what is hard work? What is focus? Right. You know, I think oftentimes a lot of people that are listening, you know, you may have a co-founder, you both have full-time jobs and you both have lives, and this is something you're doing on the side, and you're like, wait a minute, I'm the one staying up till one or two in the morning.
Look,
what do you do there?
I mean, you've got to have the courage to when the differentiation of effort first starts to feel not weighted correctly, you've got to have the conversation straight away. So that'd be number one. So always speak. If there's one thing that I wished I'd learned earlier, is to speak up quicker about anything, right? Employees underperforming, something going wrong with the company, like just got to go quick. And you got to, and you can do it in such a way that it doesn't have to be overly confrontational in the beginning. Right. The problem is that you leave it so long, then it's got to be a big confrontation. So if you do it early, it's like, hey, Michael, you know, I did about 30 hours, you know, on top of my job, like last, you know, week on the business. You got any idea what you did?
Right.
And you're going to go, you're either going to lie to me or tell me the truth and tell me you did six hours. And then we're going to go, mate, like we can't keep doing this. And you're going to go, if you're honest, you're going to go, yeah, we can't. So let's have a talk about it. And if you do that earlier than later.
Yeah. Well, it's like regularly coming back and setting the expectations off the front and then continuing to like revisit those. Right. I mean, oftentimes the expertise one person brings may not take as much time as what somebody else is doing.
Right.
We're just talking about time, but it's more like buy-in, effort, focus.
Yeah. And look, they're an unbeliever, you know, which is, I've shared my views on that. You know, I'm in business with unbelievers and that was great. You know, I've gotten to influence some, you know, as a result, but no, look, it's just expectations set up front, early conversations, no need to be overly confrontational if you talk about it regularly and early. And then there's still misalignment, you know, it's hard because he's got the second part of the question here, which is, you know, in that vein, how do you decide who gets to pay when you move from an LLC to an S corp?
The question I think is, at least what it seems like is, okay, we've been doing this on the side.
Right.
It's now time for someone to start maybe coming on and, you know, paying ourselves something.
Totally.
Or, you know, going full time.
Well, whoever does the work gets paid, right? So if the one partner who's actually doing all the work and there's actually some money to actually start paying people, non-working like executives or non-working owners or non-working board members, until the thing is really up and going and established, may get some kind of stipend as a board member or a non-executive, you know, owner. It's that they don't get money for a long time.
Right.
It's the people who are doing the work. And and so that's actually an easier moment because if one partner is going to go full-time and work the business, they're the ones going to draw the salary. The one that, the one that has a percentage, you know, is going to get profit distribution when, you know, quarterly or
when that happens. Yeah.
Right. But they're not getting paid for working the business until such time as they do. And maybe they leave their job and then they come on and they, you know, and then you've got to work that out from there. So that's actually a good moment to probably fix some of this by, you know, going an LLC, S corp, C corp, whatever. Because that's when there's a differentiator. There's revenue, there's people working hard to earn the revenue, they get paid for that.
What do you think, and I know we've probably touched on this before, but what do you think is the moment where you go, okay, me and two buddies, we're doing this thing on the side, we've got some revenue, we've been putting the money back into the business. What's the point where someone says, okay, I'm going to now leave my job and do this full time?
Right.
Is that when you've hit a ceiling in growth? Or you're missing out on growth opportunity because the focus is divided.
Right.
How do you make that decision?
Hopefully not that. Hopefully it's, you know, I need 80 grand to spend my life, right? Pay my bills and I'm earning that in my day job. And the business is now projected to do 200 in revenue, you know, and maybe you've hired a couple of people before you even. But there is this point now where you can actually draw a wage and replace what, you know, or come close to it, or maybe you cut back and take a pay cut to come on full time, right? So I just think it's, there's a moment where you have to do it because having full time more of your energy to do so is going to be really good for the business. And more focus, more time, more of your expertise going into growing your company. So as soon as you can, you should do it. And you can't bootstrap forever. Otherwise, you know, things are probably not going to work. So if there's revenue, you might hire a couple of people. You might hire an engineer or, you know, marketing before you go full-time. But you should be one of the first employees. This is when, if you're bootstrapping. Now, if you've got funding, you know, if you go raise, you know, 500K and they're giving you that 500K to go on, you've got to go work full-time. So you're going to draw, you know, a salary that is not exorbitant that's going to, because you've only got 500, right? So you've got to pay yourself and you've got to grow the company now. And you've got, you know, 12 months of runway to do it.
And so much of that is probably determined by the kind of business it is.
Yep.
Right? Whether or not you can. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Very much.
Cool. Any other thoughts? Anything you've been like reading, listened to like lately that is anything else on your mind?
No, just, you know, I think if this is a moment in history where the fundamentals of business growth are a little bit unknown, we've got geopolitics, we've got choppy markets, we've got a period of almost 20 years of just relenting growth. Like we've had an expansion, probably has been the biggest in the history of the world as far as the economy goes. And so now we've got, you know, high interest rates, high inflation. So we've got this kind of period here for maybe 12 or 18 months. In my experience, best time to start something. So the thing I'd say to young entrepreneurs is don't be discouraged by what's going on in Russia or you know, a higher interest rate environment or a high inflation environment. Those are great times to start. Now, you know, in 2000, the dot-com bubble crushed a lot of businesses. And, you know, it takes, you know, I have an old mate who's a, he's a commercial plumber and he's passed away now. But he would say to me, when things were good, anyone could be a plumber. Like when housing was up and so the quality went down. But he didn't mind when it got really hard, when the economy turned and there wasn't as much construction because all the guys that were no good got thrown out and only the guys who really knew what they're doing stayed in the business. And so, you know, there's booms and busts, ebbs and flows in everything to life. But don't be discouraged if you want to start something now because it's a fantastic time to do so.
Love that. Awesome. Dean, thank you.
Love it, man.
As usual.
Talk soon.
Hey, if you're listening and you have questions, hit us up. Reach out to us on Instagram, Twitter, email, mw@vast.faith. Yeah, reach out. We'd love to answer your question. We'd love to just talk more about what's going on with you. So hit us up.
Awesome.
And we'll see you next week. Thanks, Dean.
See ya.